about this, about 10 inches and about 10 inches in front of your face.
Hi. Oh, I'm so relieved I can see over the pulpit. That's not always the case. First, I'd like to thank Natalie for inviting me to speak to you today, and also to Teresa for the introduction, and to all of you for being here. You've been so warm and welcoming, and I thank you for that. Following the publication of my book last December about my brother Dan and the issue of belonging, boy, this is a bit loud. The Reverend Joel Tishkin, who I understand you all know well, and I'm sorry our church took him from you. He's the minister at our church now, and if there were two Joels, I'm sure one of them would still be here. I jumped at the chance to speak to our congregation, and I jumped at the chance to speak to you too, because not much, if anything, is more important to human beings than belonging. Although most of us don't consciously think about it very often, if at all, we're acutely aware of it if we don't have it. So today I'm going to talk about belonging, what it is, and why it's important to us. I'll illustrate the concept with experiences that my brother Dan has had since his traumatic brain injury 45 years ago. His life is a striking example of what the loss of belonging can do, but also of how the restoration of belonging can be positively transformative. Belonging can be loosely defined as community. The term suggests the state of being included in a network of social relationships, of being known and considered worthy of concern by those around us, of being mutually connected to people who feel some degree of personal investment in our well-being. The word belongingness refers to our sense that we belong, to feeling that we're accepted and included within a given set of relationships. As a term used within the disciplines of psychology and sociology, the scope of the network that gives us belonging can vary. I'll be using the term today, as Roy Baumeister and Mark Leary use it in their 1995 publication of their belongingness hypothesis, where they establish two criteria that satisfy our need for belongingness: that interactions be both frequent and pleasant, and that they demonstrate mutual persistent caring. So belonging and belongingness are defined more by our sense of warmth and reciprocal concern over time than by the degree of intimacy that we share. Belongingness is widely considered the idea that our need for belonging exists on the same plane as our need for food may seem like an overstatement, but Baumeister and Leary justify this claim that, as they put it, quote, a desire to form and maintain social bonds would have both survival and reproductive benefits. And of course, the evolutionary mechanism called natural selection is all about passing on characteristics that enhance the survival of a particular species by boosting the survival and reproductive success of individuals. So the result is that our need for belonging is encoded in our genetic makeup. So how is belonging so essential to survival that we evolved to need it? Well, from the minute we're born, and at various times to various degrees throughout our lives, our survival depends on others. The development of a strong drive to cultivate social connections helped early humans live longer, in many cases, long enough to reproduce and pass that drive on to others. When someone was incapacitated by injury or illness, they were unable to hunt for food, get to water, or defend themselves from predators. An apocryphal story has it that the famous sociologist Margaret Mead noted that the beginning of human civilization isn't marked by cultural artifacts, but rather by a broken femur that had healed. Why? Because its owner wouldn't have survived long enough to heal it without help from others. And our chances of survival are still enhanced by social connectedness, as we all go through periods in which we're at least temporarily unable to fend for ourselves. And at those times, if we are to survive, others have to care enough about us to help us. So as a result of our genetic imperative to connect with others, when we don't or can't connect, we suffer. Social pain theory proposes that impaired social connection causes pain, real pain, not metaphorical pain. Studies show, as Teresa noted, that social pain affects brain waves in the same ways that physical pain does. In other words, social pain really hurts. Like physical pain, it has a crucial practical function to motivate action. The purpose of physical pain is to send us a message that we need to avoid or minimize damage, like take your hand off a hot stove, don't use that broken arm until it's healed. Social pain also motivates us to take action, action that establishes or restores belonging, moves that we make that signal that we're worthy of inclusion. We align our appearance or behavior in satisfy social expectations. We apologize for damaging or disrupting relationships and make amends. We offer reasons or explanations for our transgressions, and we promise not to repeat them. We flatter or charm our way back into others' good graces. We can even offer gifts, whether material or non-material, such as by entertaining others or volunteering needed help. If we're successful in convincing others that we're worthy of their concern, belonging is restored, and the pain caused by social crisis abates. We have a problem, though, if we're unable to make any of those moves. What if, for some reason we can't control, our appearance or our physical functioning keeps us from presenting ourselves in ways that fit somewhere within social norms? Or what if we have a behavioral dysfunction or a mental illness that we're unable to bring into line? And if we can't speak or write, it's difficult, if not impossible, to explain our nonconformity or to apologize for it or to flatter or charm our way into acceptance. What happens then? What happens is that our well-being is compromised. We experience the opposite of belongingness, which is loneliness. The loneliness that results from a lack of belonging is more than a passing feeling of sadness. Because this loneliness is related to our drive to survive, it's existential. And its effects can be damaging both physically and emotionally. And a lack of belongingness can start a spiral of loneliness that's increasingly difficult to redress. Social neuroscientists John Cacioppo and Louise Hockley put it like this, quote, "Once people in a lonely person's social environment form the impression that he or she is lonely, their behaviors toward that individual can reinforce his or her negative social experiences, promote hostile or antagonistic behavior, and sustain the lonely individual's isolated existence. So people may become lonely due to an unfortunate event, but remain lonely because of the manner in which they and others think about each other." End quote. If this sounds like a vicious cycle, it is. But there's room for hope. If belonging and belongingness can be reestablished, the cycle can be broken and the damage can be repaired. My brother Dan's life history confirms the findings in the literature on belongingness and social pain. His experiences illustrate the dire problems that can result from a lack of belonging and belongingness, but they also attest to the revitalization that can follow when belongingness is restored. So, to my brother's story. When Dan was 18 years old, he was working on a ranch in Oklahoma, where he was kicked in the head by a horse. This accident resulted in severe traumatic brain injury, or TBI. From the moment he regained consciousness, some 2 months later, he began working as hard as he could to relearn skills and restore abilities that he'd lost in the accident. There's no question that his efforts at rehabilitation were aimed at regaining functionality when he relearned how to walk, bathe, brush his teeth, drive, and so on. But whether consciously or not, he was also working to regain dignity and his status as a member of society who belonged. Over the next year, Dan had regained many of the abilities and skills he had lost. Unfortunately, speech was not one of them. His TBI left him with aphasia, which is a linguistic disorder, and dysarthria, which is partial paralysis of the lips and tongue, so that he's not able to speak, and he hasn't spoken since the moment of his accident 45 years ago. Unfortunately, Dan suffered a second TBI a year later when he fell on a concrete walkway and broke the cranial plate that had replaced part of his skull the year before. This accident did much to undo the progress he'd attained over the previous year, and he lost more ground besides. He doubled down on his rehab efforts and made some headway in restoring his hard-won gains. Although he was never able to recover many of the losses inflicted by these two brain injuries, he never ceased in his efforts to take his place as an integral member of whatever community he has lived in over the decades, in a word, to belong. But Dan has faced a number of obstacles in his quest for belonging. Three have been most persistently difficult or impossible to overcome. First, his physical impairments are both serious and visible. And because a compromised physical appearance can make people uncomfortable, he's often shunned on the basis of appearance alone. Because of the severity of his brain injury, there was and is little he can do about that. Second, Dan has a condition that is very common, if not universal, among people with severe TBI, called intermittent explosive disorder, or IED. Neural damage to the circuitry of his brain resulted in a reduced capacity for managing emotions. When his level of frustration and anger reaches a certain point, he loses control. His face twists with rage. He yells. He flails his arms. He waves his middle finger. He may kick tables or knock things off of them. Typically, this rage blows through him and is over in about a minute or so. But in those moments, Dan is the very picture of uncontained fury. He looks and sounds unhinged, irrational, aggressive, and potentially violent. Not surprisingly, these moments, short-lived though they are, have alienated many people over time, and the result has typically been a withdrawal of sociality and belonging. The third obstacle is Dan's inability to speak. Aphasia and dysarthria have often made communication, and so interpersonal interaction, challenging. It's certainly possible to communicate with Dan. He fully understands everything that's said to him. He's a master of facial expression and gesture, and he can use a letter board or the manual alphabet on his fingers to spell out single words, although he can't always find the words he needs. Communicating with Dan is therefore typically slow and sometimes laborious, requiring considerable patience from both his conversation partner and from Dan himself. Many people lack the patience or assume from his appearance and his inability to speak that talking with him is a lost cause, or jump to conclusions that have little bearing on what he is meaning to say. His difficulty communicating has severely impacted his ability to gain and retain belonging. As to the social strategies we typically use to repair rifts in belonging, Dan's impairments have greatly complicated matters. His various impairments have made it impossible for Dan to meet social expectations for self-presentation. His aphasia and dysarthria hinder apologies or explanations for his transgressions. He's unable to offer help with needed tasks, and it's harder for him to flatter or charm interactants, or tell stories or make jokes. Dan's TBI has interfered with his ability to repair compromised relationships for 45 years, and so he has been in an almost continual state of social crisis for decades. Being excluded by those around him, including an array of caregivers, led to acute loneliness and the social pain and existential fear that stems from our radical experience of belonging as a matter of survival. Over the years, Dan was repeatedly ejected from programs he went to for help, and he was evicted from one of the places he went to live. The level of Dan's belonging reached a critical low at a nursing home in Georgia, where over time, and largely because of problems with his IED, he lost any claim to belonging. A month into the process of moving him from that nursing home to Muncie, I discovered that he was being chemically restrained. Caregivers were circumventing his IED bursts by doping him into continual semi-consciousness. Although the drug was discontinued as soon as I found out about it, 2 months later, he was rushed to an emergency room with sepsis. Medical personnel discovered that he was also severely malnourished and dehydrated. When he arrived in Muncie just 10 weeks later, he weighed 108 pounds. I won't go into the details now about how he ended up in that precarious position, but to sum up my analysis of it, the lack of belonging he suffered as a result of his IED and his inability to mend relationships in their aftermath led to neglect and medical abuse. But just as the loss of belonging can be fatal, as Dan's story suggests, when belonging is restored, it can be revitalizing. And Dan's story shows that too. At the Georgia hospital where he was treated for sepsis, his doctor recommended that he enter hospice. But after moving to Muncie, Dan began to thrive. COVID caused some disruption, and we're still working on ways to improve his quality of life. We always are working on that. But 5 years after leaving Georgia, Dan is healthy, both physically and emotionally. I attribute this radical shift from life-threatening misery to general contentment to an increase in his levels of belonging and belongingness. We've worked hard together to establish belonging, especially with his caregivers, and we've worked together to help mend it when IED episodes interfere. In the past couple of years, he's declined a bit physically, but probably less than I have, but I find the transformation in his well-being an unmitigated joy. A stable foundation of belonging and belongingness has made a raft of changes possible. I wrote a recently published book about Dan's life that furnishes more context and details than I can give here today. But when I began the book, I had no idea I'd be writing about belongingness. Patterns emerged as I wrote, and as I launched into research to try to make sense of those patterns, the literature took me to the topics of belonging and belongingness. What I learned brought those patterns into high definition. And because belonging and belongingness are universal and basic to who we are, I began seeing the patterns they create everywhere. Dan's life offers a quintessential study of the same mechanics that are at work in all of us. And once we're aware of the dynamic, we can better understand our own needs and the needs of others. And maybe we can approach them differently with better results. I've used what I now know about belonging to help Dan reconstruct a better life. And I don't think I could have been as effective had I not written that book that taught me so much. In closing, I'll note that another example of the power of belonging and belongingness is evident in this church. When we talk about beloved community, we're talking about the belongingness that we give each other. 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, and I've gotten and continue to get great care from both my husband and the medical professionals who attend me. But also people in my home church, some of whom my husband and I hardly knew, checked in with us periodically to see how we were doing. They sent cards, they brought flowers, brought meals. In short, they let us know that they cared. I know that I have managed better overall because of those reassurances of concern. And for me, there's not a better example of the life-affirming power of belonging. Thanks.